Hi everybody, thank you very much for downloading our podcast. This is to listeners of Culturally Fixated and to Leeds Book Club, because we have a very multi-talented guest with us tonight. In fact, we have the Queen of the CNC and a genuine geek goddess, General Susan Ivanova herself, Claudia Christian. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Wow, what an introduction. I don't know if I can live up to that. You might as well put Queen of the Universe in there.
Well, you know, you have a lot of fans, and I'm not going against any of them who say that you are. You know?
No, I've had such an incredible supportive group over the years. It's been amazing. I was just talking to a friend of mine about that. I thought, what other profession do you get 20 years of full-on support and love and you know, even if you want to look, I'm not a good singer, but I put out a bunch of albums and lo and behold, the fans buy them, you know. But it's more than that. It seems like we're taking this journey together, you know. I did the show in the 90s, and yet there's still people that I know and that I meet, and I consider them friends. So it's been amazing. I mean, I think sci-fi is that, and genre in general, is this gateway to relationships that you wouldn't have otherwise. You wouldn't meet these people in other avenues of industry. I don't think so. At least maybe I'm jaded, but you know.
No, I'm a sci-fi fan.
I think you're pretty special, put it that way.
Well, I'm a sci-fi fan to the core, and it began when I was very little, working my way through, you know, Isaac Asimov and Robert Silverberg, and this, yeah. You know, they always featured prominent female characters, which was brilliant for me as a little girl reading them, thinking I'm not just going to be the three-breasted alien woman from Total Recall or something, you know. But it was so amazing to be able to turn on the television and see people like that, you know, like in Star Trek, and sci-fi seemed to be that area where it was considered completely acceptable, in fact necessary. You needed to demonstrate in the future that there was equality, or you know, demonstrate that there wasn't, and it was a bad thing. And in mainstream television, it was like, yeah, we'll continue to make them secretaries and have them bring us coffee on screen, you know. So
absolutely. Well, even early sci-fi did that. They denigrated the women to be the coffee getters or the secretaries or something. And I've had over the years, which is so wonderful, you know, little girls say to me, wow, you made me believe that I could be the commander. yay!
Well, I'm genuinely going to have a massive geek out session with you about Babylon 5. So I think, well, but I actually think it's more fair to you, your career in general, if we start with other things. And I looked up a couple of other topics because I thought, okay, I know I can talk about Babylon 5 for hours, but presumably, you know, after this much time, you would like to talk about some of your other things. I couldn't get over what I found. You speak three languages other than English fluently and are happy to act in them. You play the piano and the guitar. You called yourself a not very good singer. I wouldn't agree with that at all. And I went and listened to the tracks online and stuff, you know. You definitely had a very Madonna vibe going through the 90s, which is...
Oh, well, that's flattering. And by the way, I can get by in three languages, but I'm not, I do not call myself fluent. That's probably some publicist from the 90s that said that. And I'm probably... I'm a great swimmer. I'm an excellent chef, but I don't consider myself an expert really at anything at this point in my life. I'm humbled to be able to do what I love, which is write books, make movies, and now help people. So I think all of the stuff that people read on the internet sometimes, it's embarrassing because it sounds like I'm this uber perfect woman.
You do come across a little bit like a Renaissance woman, and that's before we even touch on your writing career, the fact that you're making a documentary, you're a director, as well as a screenwriter. You know, it's a little intimidating.
No, it just means that I wasn't getting enough acting gigs to talk about. No, it's called diversification. One has to diversify, especially in the profession that I'm in. So luckily, because I'm really not good at maths or science or anything like that, I find that anything creative was what I was drawn to. So when you say, yeah, okay, I wrote some books, I did this, so, you know, I directed some television or whatever, it's because I wanted to stay busy, and I wasn't always employed as in my what used to be my favorite field, which was acting.
Yeah.
So I think one learns to find things to do and a way to make a living. I mean, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, did I think that I would be a landlord, author, documentary filmmaker in 2013, I'd be like, wait a minute, no, I'm supposed to be starring in a television series, you know. But so you don't know. I mean, you don't know what life pans out for you, but you have to make the best of it and you have to keep changing. It's like a snake on sand, you know, find the cool spot. And that's what I've been doing for, luckily, you know, I've been able to do the things I love for 30 years, but it does change. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if you love one thing, you have to stay on that path, because sometimes life dictates that that path isn't going to pay you, so you can't, you know.
Yeah.
So you have to do other things.
And
so.
But it's all, I mean, look at Ron Howard, who started life out as an actor and is now such a prominent...
I did a film with him, Clean and Sober.
Oh, well...
He's a lovely man. He's a lovely, lovely, lovely man, and he deserves all the success that he got. Yeah, he was a child star.
Yeah, but he found... in later life, a focus that has kept him going, you know, professionally.
Absolutely.
And creatively,
yeah.
You know, for such a long time. So often, what was that? You remember that Baz Luhrmann song that came out, the Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen? And he said that some of the most interesting people that he knew at 20 didn't know what they wanted to do with their lives. Some of the most interesting people he ever met didn't know at 40. And I've always thought that's, you know, that's how to approach it. Every year brings a new challenge, you know.
Well, it's interesting. I sat on a plane next to a woman who was 60, and this is the first time I came out to England. I was moving country, and it was 2005. I think I was about to do Star Hike in Bristol, and I remember this sitting next to this woman, and I said, you know, I'm scared. You know, I'm selling my house in LA, and I'm moving to a country. She said, darling, I was a psychotherapist, and then I became a sex therapist, then I became a tennis pro, and now I just am married. And I went, wow, here's this, you know, this is a woman who's lived four lives, and she was 60, and she said, I'm starting this one anew because I never thought it would satisfy me. And I thought, wow, okay, so, you know, it's every decade brings a new promise or a new failure or a new hope or whatever it is, but you got to hang in there.
The first thing that I ever saw you in was actually Freaks and Geeks.
Ah, that's, yeah, that was lovely.
Gloria...
Havertuck,
that was it.
I played Martin Starr's mom. I did only a couple of episodes, but it was a really great experience. Judd Apatow, of course, went on to become an incredibly successful director-producer. Who hasn't put me in any of his features? Not that I'm bitter about that.
No, the bastard.
I did the Vanity Fair shoot last year, and I walked right up to him and I said, "So how come I'm the only one from Freaks and Geeks in a movie?" Subtle party of one. And he looked at me and he was like, just speechless, and I thought, "Wow, Claudia, you."
Because you're scary and you march up to me and say weird things.
God, it's just I have no filter. I have to go out and buy one.
Well, I mean, that is something that comes across so much in your autobiography, Babylon Confidential. Love, sex, and what is it? What's the tagline for it?
Addiction.
Love, sex, and addiction. That's kind of like the three things you're not supposed to, along with God, that's like the three things you're not supposed to bring up in a pub. Do you know what I mean?
No, if you're going to be, first of all, if you have the cheek to write a memoir at the age of 45, which is how old I was when I started it, then you better have something important to say. And also, if you're going to do that, then you better be honest. And if you're going to pretend to be able to help people, then you had better be absolutely 100% dead honest. And I decided either I'm going to come clean and I'm going to show the ugly and the middle and the, you know, all the best and worst, or I'm not going to write it at all. And also, how am I going to approach somebody who I am really, really keen to help if I'm not honest about what I went through?
Yeah.
Because they're not going to be able to be honest with me. And I think the thing that has helped so, just so much, is the fact that I was so blunt in my book that now people feel free to come to me and say, look, I'm sneaking alcohol, I'm doing this, I'm
Yeah.
lying to my mate, I'm, you know, my partner, I'm having, you know, my children are affected. I mean, they're really being incredibly honest with me because I was honest with them.
Yeah.
So it seems more like an open relationship per se. And it's actually made me closer, not only to my fans, who it's ironic because most sci-fi and genre fans aren't addicts. They're addicted to food and sci-fi conventions, not alcohol or drugs. So what I'm finding is that they tell that their friends who tell family members and so on and so forth. And I've put about 100 and something in between. In America, it's about 50 plus, and then all around the world, it's about 100 plus people on the Sinclair method. So all of these people I keep in touch with, and that's really become my focus. And in getting back to the book, if I wasn't honest in that book, then I would not be able to help these people right now, because they needed to understand that I was not pretending that this was easy for me. I wasn't pulling any punches as far as, oh, look what I, you know, oh, I got over it. No, I didn't get over anything. You know, I went through hell and I came out the other end because I found something that worked for me, but I failed at every other traditional attempt.
Yeah.
And, you know, they call it failure, but I call it, you know, the search.
No,
and
I mean,
so, you know,
the perseverance comes through so much. I mean, I was sort of half saying it to you earlier. I think your autobiography, it reads a little bit like a fairy tale. I likened it when I was describing it to somebody, to The Wizard of Oz. It begins with your life in Kansas, which was your life growing up, where you had some really painful experiences, including the loss of your brother, but also a graphically violent, you know, sex attack. Then we move to the Technicolor stage, which is when you break free, you go and you pursue acting. And the way you talk about your love for the craft, it does seem as though it's a relationship. When you invest in it, it gives back to you. And there were times in your life where you were able to sort of, you know, take a bit of time and give yourself other activities, but it's something that you keep crawling back to, and it's always there to embrace you. And it was really exciting to read that, to read about that sort of passion about for anything. And then we sort of get to the real world bit, where the facade cracks a little bit and realities such as the fact that you were drinking to excess to the detriment of your health, and it was impacting on your relationships. And it was sort of staggering to move from one, you know, from to think about one phase of your life that was so almost butterfly colorful, that this had happened. But your perseverance, the fact that you kept trying and you found this method that seems to have just transformed you, it's a very inspirational, you know, but painful journey.
I like the way your analogy to The Wizard of Oz. That's interesting. I never thought about that, but it is true, because my childhood was in black and white, and then there was that period of everything falling into place. And I say to people now, I don't know how I could start today and work as much as I did, because the industry was different when I started. When I started in 1983, it was six of us girls, and we competed with each other. I mean, it was literally such a tiny pond.
Yeah.
And because we were the ones that were good, or that we looked a certain way, or what, and you know, we'd say, oh, she got it. Oh, I got it. Or, you know, we would know who got the gigs, because we would, you know, you saw the same people at auditions, and you had a decent agent, and you worked all the time. I mean, I worked all the time. I got my first job when I was 18 years old, and I never stopped working until I was in my 30s, early 30s. So for a good, you know, I had a good 15-year run, or, you know, and nothing really bad happened to me until my late 30s, when this started to occur. I realized that, you know, I couldn't control something in my life, which was weird because I'm a control freak. I mean, I'm disciplined. I love my life. I'm a happy person. So why would this happen to me?
Yeah.
Genetically, of course, I had the predisposition. Both of my grandfathers, you know, were alcoholics later in life, same age almost as me, and binge drinkers. So it did correlate, and I have a brother who's an addict, so I got it, but I didn't get it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't really sink in. It doesn't sink in because it's you, and you're strong, and you love yourself. So you don't understand why you can't handle, you know, anything like this. And addiction is a very strange thing. I mean, I've talked to bulimics. I've talked to self-harmers. I've talked to anorexics, opiate addicts. I mean, a myriad of people who don't understand what is taking over their body, and what they don't understand is that the learned behavior of addiction is something that can be undone. And I knew that in the back of my head. I knew that I wanted to be normal. I didn't want to be somebody who was going to a meeting every day for the rest of my life. I didn't want to be somebody who relied upon prayer. I have a very strong connection to my spirit life, but I didn't feel that that was a solution. I come from a family of doctors, of scientists. I wanted a physiological, a medical solution. And I wanted to be the person I was before. And that's what took me on this journey. And it's been an extraordinary journey, but it was, relatively, when you're talking about people, I mean, you're talking about the Anthony Hopkins of the world who've been sober for 30 years or struggled for 25 years. Mine was a relatively, in the scope of things, it was a pretty small part of my life, but it was still, I consider it a waste of 8 to 10 years of my life. Just pretty big.
Terrifying to think, like, when you put it in those sort of terms.
When you put it in that, that's, if you look at it right now, that's about a fifth of my life. You know, that I feel, had I known about this in the very beginning of my problem, I could have saved that period of time.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I wouldn't be the person I am today helping people had I not gone through
that. And I mean, I know that in the book you're very clear about what the Sinclair method, which I think naltrexone and nalmefene are the two that are used.
It's naltrexone, nalmefene, and naloxone.
Oh, and naloxone.
In the UK now, they have a thing called Cilincro. And Cilincro is actually nalmefene, which you can take if you have liver damage. In the US, they mostly prescribe naltrexone. Mm. They're all opiate blockers. They're incredibly innocuous. They're very low grade, declassified prescriptions. In other words, you could more easily OD on aspirin
than you could on
paracetamol, yeah, whatever it's called in this country, than you could on one of these opiate blockers. They've been used for everything from multiple sclerosis to, in very low doses. They use them for neurological disorders. They were used to bring heroin addicts out of overdose.
Overdose, yeah.
Yeah, so this is, like I said, it's an incredibly safe drug. It's a non-addicting drug. Mm. The side effects are incredibly minimal.
Mm.
And it really is the answer to this billion-dollar, multi-life lost issue in all over the world. I mean, we're talking about one of the most costly issues, health issues, in the world. And in the UK right now, the binging has become so excessive. So they're really selling the Sinclair method right now in the form of Cilincro as the anti-binge medication. Because if you pay $1 or £1 in this country for a pill, and you pay £5 for a pint or £3 for a pint, what they're saying is, we'll help you cut down.
Yeah.
And that makes it more palatable than saying to somebody, I'm going to cure you.
Yeah.
So the whole point of this is saying, look, I want you to help, I want to help you get your alcohol drinking under control.
Mm.
And that's the difference between this and the absolute 100% sobriety of abstinence and rehab. And we don't even have the time to discuss all this, but that puts you into alcohol deprivation, and you're talking about something that doesn't help the obsession and the compulsion of addiction.
Mm.
And this actually undoes it in the brain. So you could actually call it a pharmacological extinction, which is what they refer to it as, which is what occurs after 3 to 4 months when you're on the Sinclair method.
It basically, if what I was reading was correct, it rewires your brain back to how it should be.
Exactly.
So that if you choose to, you can abstain completely. But if you go back to being a drinker rather than an alcoholic or a former drinker, it's like it's obviously it's not a magic pill, and it's...
Well, you have to stay on it. That's why this is the difference. It's just like a diabetic stays on insulin, or just like anybody stays on their medication.
Mm.
If you go off of it, let's say you don't take your antibiotics, you're going to get influenced again.
Yeah.
So it's a relapse thing. You will relearn the learned behavior. Mm. It is a learned behavior.
And it really puts the emphasis on alcoholism as a medical problem, as in, like, why should we presume, as people have done for so long, that if you want to give up, it's a matter of willpower?
Oh, that's
if we recognize that people are addicts, Then of course the insulin you know, the insulin analogy is even more apt, because you're basically just suggesting that you're putting somebody on a lifelong course of medication, which we do all the time.
Well, think of it this way. Does somebody walk into a pub at the age of 20, have their first drink, and turn into an alcoholic? No. It's a learned behavior. What happens in addicts is that your endorphins are, the rush is so much more strengthened. And when those endorphins are released and they hit that opiate, receptor, and they hang there, they strengthen that neural pathway much stronger than the average person would, the normal person would. So an addict, their neural pathways get strengthened, 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 and all these things are firing, all these endorphins are firing. So they want, that's when you get the compulsion to want more and more and more. And if anyone understands that, if they look at brain scans and they look at the before and after pictures of somebody on the Sinclair method before and after, they will understand that it literally undoes what wasn't there before. So I'm very, very hesitant about saying the words disease or cure or even alcoholism, because I think that it's a learned behavior. The more you drink, the more you become an addict. Same thing with cocaine or opiates or anything else, or binge eaters. The more you do it, the more your body craves it. Fat, sugar, all of these things. And it's ironic that the same endorphins that you're releasing when you cuddle a baby or when you eat spicy food is also the same, or when you gamble or if you're a sex addict. It's the same thing. And it's a compulsion to make you want more and more and more. What this does, this opiate blocker does, is it basically meets those endorphins and it blocks them from firing. So you can still get drunk, you can still enjoy a glass of wine, but you don't want to get drunk. You're not the last man standing at the bar, but you can still be the normal person having a glass of wine or a couple of drinks or whatever. Or 48% or more, actually, we're finding, go completely sober. So we're not telling you to go sober,
That's what people can choose to do, and it's a choice returned
but
to
it's not
them.
even, it's actually beyond choice. It is a lot of people that are on the Sinclair method simply lose all desire to drink, and that's almost 50%.
Which, I
that's a
mean,
pretty high statistic.
That's incredibly high.
It also has a long-term wise, it has an 80% long-term success rate, and anything else like AA and rehab can barely claim 10%. So we're talking about the best treatment worldwide, and the fact that it's not known is just it to me, it's like, it would be as if there was a cure for cancer out there and
and
no one was
nobody,
telling, but
Well,
because
you,
we kill, millions and millions of people every year.
I mean, you're hoping to change that. You've become the ambassador or one of them for the C3 Foundation, and I believe there's a documentary in the works.
Yes, I started the C3 Foundation because I wanted to give people information that they could download and bring to their doctors, and just to heighten awareness of the Sinclair method. And our first project is this documentary. So I'm in London right now, and we're going to be filming Dr. Roy Escapa, who wrote The Cure for Alcoholism. And really, really thrilling for me is then we're going to Helsinki, and I get to meet Dr. David Sinclair, the man who saved my life. So I'm incredibly
Will
excited
this be
about
your
that.
first time to meet him?
I've never met Dr. Sinclair. I've met Escapa a few times.
Oh wow, that's gonna
He, Roy
be
and I have a very good friendship, and we have the same publisher for our books, but no, I've never met Dr. Sinclair, and I'm just absolutely
Well, I mean,
excited.
that's going to be surreal, and I say that aware of the fact that you're practically Forrest Gump. Your autobiography is just littered with very casual references in many cases to really significant people who've done these amazing things, and you were just like, oh hey Bob, that's Robert De Niro, you know. And okay, some of the stories are less pretty. How you acquired funding for the Buffalo documentary, or a short film that unfortunately never came to fruition. I'm just like, that's the dad from Psych. That's so wrong.
That was a really disgusting story, but I had to include it because it really is indicative of Hollywood. I mean,
It's also
it created this
hilarious.
beautiful spiritual feature film I wanted to make, and how do I get I guess you guys
But
have to read the book to find out why.
yeah,
I'm
I
not gonna
mean,
say it. I'm not gonna say it.
you have met everybody. You've worked with everybody. And in fact, you wrote very touchingly about your sort of long-term career and friendship with Jeff Conaway, who, it's, you know, inspired so many people from very early in his career onwards, but sadly succumbed to his own addictions.
Yeah, he was a lovely man. And it is funny how he came in and out of my life. In 1983, we did Behringer's together with Anita Morris filling out the love triangle. Mm. And then we did a film with Adam Erskine, Tale of Two Sisters.
Two Sisters, we did together.
Yeah, and then we ended up on Babylon 5 together. So that spans 20 years at least. So,
But I'll obviously... I'm moving on to the Babylon 5 stuff. I'm just not going to be able to contain myself. But your relationships as well, I mean, the long-standing relationship you have with Europe, and not least some of its most premier and established bachelors, is goes back. But you're very honest about some of your more negative relationships, including one that you said was just very toxic for the pair of you, with... Yeah. The Braveheart star. God, I'm so crap with names. I want to say Angus.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the way you wrote about that, I mean, you know, Susan Ivanova was a strong woman and she stood up for herself. And I didn't come across Babylon 5 until I was at university, but I was so inspired by her. And I know so many people who love science fiction and chose the careers they chose despite being male dominated because they had role models like her to look up to. But there must be women, you know, who are not faced with life and death decisions, who are reading those passages in a book going, really? Her?
Yeah, and I was doing Babylon 5 when I lived with him, when he lived with me, I should say. Yeah, so it is interesting playing this heroic, strong, very decisive character and then coming home every day saying, what am I doing? You know, I think everything influences your life for the good and the bad, and I don't believe that there is a 100% negativity even in negative relationships because of what you learn and how you grow from it, and also what your expectations of the next time around. Mm. And what you will and will not put up with, and what you also believe that you deserve, and you know, part of life is the floundering. It is the fishing. It is the sticking your neck out and saying, ooh, I didn't like that. It's the trying of flavors. It's, you know, the whole experience. And so it's satisfying for me. And I think that's why when people say, I can't believe you wrote that, you know, oh, my God, it's so shocking, blah, blah. Well, for me, I'm over it. Mm. I'm done. You know,
You've come out the other side stronger.
Yeah, so it's absolutely cathartic. It might be shocking for you guys to read it, and it may be shocking for, you know, people to read these excerpts or these experiences, but for me, I've dealt with it. Mm. If I hadn't have dealt with it and come out the other end, I wouldn't be writing about it. You know, I have to have something to be able to teach from. So it's not a midway catharsis. It's more of a looking back at that woman thinking, God, I wish I was the person today.
Yeah.
But I couldn't be, you know, you can't be who you are at 40 when you were 20. And that's why when everybody says, you know, youth is wasted on the young, I wouldn't want to be 20 again. Mm. You know, there's nothing, I like, you know, this life experience, no matter how painful it was, no matter how horrific it was, it made me who I am today. And that's, you know, somebody that can maybe help other people with what I've been through. So there's nothing wrong with.
I noticed on your Twitter feed, I think, that your book is available as an audiobook, and that you...
Yeah, finally, after all this time.
Yeah, well, actually, I was just going to say, like, were there any bits that, while you're reading them aloud...
Yes,
There must have been some moments where...
I cried during my brother dying.
Yeah.
I cried, and I cried a couple of times, actually. I had to stop. Mm. I think it's pretty easy to, if someone's listening to the audiobook, I think they'll know when I choked up, because I don't know how they edited it. I haven't heard it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was not easy.
No, that must have been strange.
It was weird. It was surreal, because you're reading this, and I felt sorry for that little girl. Isn't that weird? I didn't really say, wow, that's me. I just felt like I wanted to give that little girl a hug.
And it'll all turn out okay.
That's the little me, you know. it's a very surreal thing when you're reading. It's the same thing as, it's funny because people always say, oh, don't you get angry when you watch movies and you see all the, you know, the things that go wrong, like, you know, if it doesn't match or there's, you know, consistency that, yeah, whatever. And I always get so caught up in the stories that even if it's me playing a character, I can still get moved. It's like the scene in Babylon 5 where Marcus has died and I'm crying with Richard Biggs, you know, and when I watch that, I get teary. It's not because I'm watching my acting. It's because I'm thinking, how sad.
He just died.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't think people understand that, you know, I'm not one of these people that watch and go, oh, my makeup doesn't look good, or gee, no. I get into the story and say, oh God, she should have kissed. She should have loved him.
We're there, and I mean, Babylon 5 is just, it's obviously still a huge part of your life. I didn't come across it till I was at uni, and a friend of mine, Beth, lent me the first season box set, and I was totally intrigued. It obviously had an overlying arc, you know, that was going to play out. When I put on episode one of season two, I was just like, hey, hang on, they've swapped the main guy. What's
yeah.
what's going on here? This is, it's a whole different show. And then within about 5 minutes, I think I was equally gripped in a different way. But I mean, you made that. You were there. You ruled the, you know, Babylon 5. People would scuttle out of your way when, you know, if you didn't have a coffee in hand. I mean, what was it like?
It was wonderful. It was probably one of the best experiences of my 30-year career, because we really, really were these little underdogs sitting in this crappy studio in Sun Valley, California,
yeah,
and everybody thought we would fail, so we were the little train, you know, and we had no idea that we were even successful over the pond until we came to England, and it was phenomenal. Finally, somebody got it, you know, because they knew Doctor Who and Red Dwarf, and you know, it was a country that got sci-fi. But you have to understand, back in the you know, early mid 90s when we were on, sci-fi was not that popular in America. Mm. I mean, it wasn't until Battlestar Galactica, the new one, mm, and all that came, that it was cool, and Buffy and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we were just these weirdos that were making this show that nobody got until it started to catch on, and real diehard sci-fi fans started to appreciate the writing and the acting. And
it doesn't reset at the end of every episode. It carries forward. And I mean,
exactly.
For those of us who grew up on Trek, that in itself, like, they, you know, you'd have characters unexpectedly pregnant, you know, in an episode because they couldn't hide it anymore. But but it wasn't, you know, you didn't expect any sort of overlying.
Well, and it opened the door for the Game of Thrones mentality of saying this is an epic story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's, you know, people like to say that it was Casablanca in space, and I don't think so. I think it was almost more of a soap in space, but a smart soap opera. Mm. You know, I mean, it was a space opera. I mean,
yeah,
you had a very Wagnerian opera.
Mm.
You know, you had these characters that came in and out, and of course, because JMS had to deal with people coming and going, or you know, reasons to leave the series, he had to constantly adapt.
Mm.
Not getting the money for the fifth season meant that he had to jam 4 and 5 into one season. So all of these things led to a very organic, very heightened experience, and for me, it was just amazing. I've never been on a set where everybody really loved each other, and if somebody was an arse, they got fired. If somebody was a prima donna, they get sucked out of an airlock.
Yeah,
I mean, we didn't put up with stuff like that because we had to work, you know, so quickly and so succinctly. And we had half the budget that a normal Star Trek episode did. We made these shows for $750,000 an episode, I think, something like that. I mean, crazy. They were spending over $2 million an episode. And we worked a very, very clean 12 and a half hours a day, 13 hours a day, except for the aliens that were working a few more hours for makeup. But because of that, you really had to know your stuff. You had to know your lines. You had to get in and get out. And you had to get along. And we did genuinely like each other. I mean, I still hang out with you know, Mira and Andrea and Pat Tallman. I mean, these are my friends. I mean,
I know that I know that you did an album together, the B5s.
Yeah. They re-released it with two songs that were
re-released
dedicated to the cast members that have passed. Yeah,
yeah, and to be honest, I mean, that more than anything is an indicator of how much time has gone by. Like, it's surprising how many of the stars have now, you know, been taken from us.
We had dinner with Richard Biggs' widow, Laurie Biggs, and just a couple weeks before I came to London, we all had dinner with Pat Tomlin and Laurie and Bill Mooney and his wife. And
he seems like the best crack, Bill Mooney.
Yeah, but the kids were like teenagers.
When did that happen? Like,
wow, I thought, wow, that's time really, really does fly.
I mean, one of the my favorite overall episode was the Cobbled Together season 4 finale, because I gather that they just found out that they didn't need to use the actual series finale, and they decided to come up with an alternative, and they project in the future 100 years, 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years.
Oh no, you're talking about the very last episode that they showed.
That was shot a year before, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've never seen I've never seen 3, 4, or 5, but the last episode that I shot was the one that they showed as the very last episode. The one in the future where General Ivanova,
yes. In fact, the story does continue. There was a short story, wasn't there? I've got the name written down here. Space, Time, and the Incurable Romantic. Oh, we're cool.
Talk.
Okay. I was just wondering if you knew that there was a continuation called Space, Time, and the Incurable Romantic. And it's...
No, is it fan fiction?
No, it was written by... Oh, I'm going to say his name wrong, but Joe Straczynski?
Well, that's the creator of Babylon 5. JMS is Joe Straczynski.
Yeah, he wrote this because he always wanted to write what he would have liked for Marcus and never got the chance to. And it's set sort of 300 years in the future. They finally found a way to fix that machine that... Oh, spoiler alert, by the way, people. 20-year-old spoiler alerts coming up here. but yeah, they finally found a way of like fixing the machine that sucked out all of Marcus's life. And he comes to, but he's set 300 years in the future. Everyone he knows has died. So they've set this huge amount of money, you know, that Delenn and Ivanova had like put in his name, and obviously it's accumulated interest, and he spends every penny on it buying a spaceship, a small colony planet in the middle of nowhere, and setting it up so that no one will ever find it. And then he clones Ivanova using like her hair and some timestamp memories, so that when she wakes up, she thinks she's Ivanova. He crashes the spaceship into this little planet, and it like ends knowing that they're gonna spend their time together.
So I'm stuck with Jason Carter on an island. What you're saying, basically.
Yeah, it must. I mean, it sounds like torture to me.
that's an interesting. And I've heard tales of that story before, but wow.
It ends well for Marcus, but I was never entirely sure what Ivanova would make of it.
What the benefit of it? Oh God, that's funny.
Do you have any favorite episodes or quotes from the series?
You know, I always enjoyed the ones where I had stuff to do. So that would be, you know, the purple green Drazi episode and the. I loved the whole end of it, you know, where, I mean, for me, my death and his death, and because it was, you know, some dramatic acting as opposed to just parking ships and CNC. So.
The common everyday acting stuff.
Exactly.
And of course, you got an unexpected comedic turn in Acts of Sacrifice.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And the actors were so good.
You looked demented.
We had so many wonderful guest stars on that show. I have to say that it's when I look back on it. I mean, Michael York,
Arthur, of course.
I mean, you know, it was wonderful.
And and obviously you got to play things that you just wouldn't get in a procedural or a cop show or something, you know, and some of the, it's hard to describe to someone when you're describing Babylon 5 and you bring up all the big arcs and it's good versus evil and there's angels and demons and then you go, oh yeah, but there's also this like Jewish lady whose father's died and it's really sad and she's got no family left. Yeah. And you know, there's a captain whose wife was like, she might be dead, but she might have been kidnapped by shadows, you know?
Yeah, that whole thing with the two wives and the this and that and then the Melissa Gilbert coming in, and you know, that got a little confusing for me too, believe me.
But they were very consistent with Susan. She was always miserable.
Well, you know, I think it was just I think it was just at first in the beginning. She was the new kid on the block, and she had to act like that. Everybody, you know, so that was why she had a pole up her butt. And then later on, her humor started to come through. But I don't think she was ever really comfortable because she was the youngest lieutenant commander, I mean, at that point. And she was always trying to prove herself. And as far as her love life was, clearly she was undecided sexually. So she was, you know, possibly I mean, how do you describe a latent telepath, bisexual, Russian, Jewish commander? I mean,
Claudia Christian, it's obvious.
Yeah, she had some issues, but I think she was one of my favorite characters to play because I just thought the way that it was written started to encompass a bit of my personality and humor as well, because Joe observed all of us, and so all of our characters. There was a bit of Richard Biggs in Dr. Franklin. You know, there was a bit of Sheridan. You know, a little bit of Bruce Boxleitner, his cockiness in there, a little bit of his sensitivity. And I think Joe found a way to tap into all these reserves of the actors that were quite lovely. I mean, you have to be really stupid to think that there wasn't something in Delenn that was part of Mira and her tragic, you know, Balkan upbringing and the war and everything.
Yeah.
And what she had been through personally definitely showed.
And then, you know,
Delenn. And of course she could play that. She was passionate about those things.
And Peter Jurassic brought a humanity to
Because Peter
Londo.
Jurassic is one of the most humane, beautiful souls you'll ever meet.
Well, I mean, I hope it's him. Yeah. Otherwise, I have very iffy feelings about a serial killer, genocidic king,
I'm
you know.
Kidding. You know, I mean, he's probably one of the nicest men you'd ever meet in your life. And so, you know, it was just this magical combination of people, great writer, and then, you know, the few writers that filled in with Joe, but mostly Joe, obviously, and an extraordinary cast, an extraordinary guest cast, and an extraordinary crew. And it was just this weird, kismety, great 4 or 5 years that I am very grateful to have been part of, because it stands up even today.
A new generation of sci-fi fan are introduced to it every
dressed up as a sci-fi.
Well, our last thing, and then I promise I'll let you get back to your real life. You're famous for your interactions with your fan base, how honest you've always been, how open you've always been, despite the fact that you have been attacked by several quite crazed individuals, including one who clearly didn't remember shooting you a decade later, which I wouldn't have thought is the sort of incident you'd rapidly put in the back of your mind. And you actually held your own con. You did your own. I'm a con goer. And you held your very own one in 2011. And people are always asking if there's more, if there are new ones. So it seems to be very popular.
The irony of that, of course, is that, you know, it sounded like it was a really good idea. And then right in the middle of that weekend, the London riots began and the bicycle race. So out of the few hundred people that were going to show up, the majority of them canceled. So we had about 25 media guests and maybe 40 guests. So the media guests started leaving, of course. I didn't blame them because they weren't going to make any money. But we had this core group of fans that were so sweet and so loyal staying there. But the funny thing is that, you know, we sold a couple hundred tickets, but nobody, they were all afraid to fly there because they heard about these riots. And I kept saying, we're at Heathrow. Nothing's going to happen.
It's not London. It's actually quite different.
It's really safe, but nobody believed me. So it was a very it took me 9 months to throw that convention. It was like having a baby, and it wasn't. I have to say, at the end of the day, it was an interesting experience, but I would never do it again. It was so much work, I had these, you know, pipe dreams of being able to give lots of money to charities and do all this stuff, and then at the end of the day, we were struggling to, you know, to pay the hotel and everything. Yeah. So it was, you know, but the fans were once again unbelievably supportive, and you know, there were people that came out of the woodwork and started selling, you know, memorabilia and stuff to help, and it was just. They're just the most amazing people I've ever met in my life, and I'm so grateful to have been part of that community, because I've never met people who are that enthusiastic about something. I mean, you can have soap opera fans and you can have film fans, but sci-fi fans are diehards.
Yeah.
They are just diehards, and
you'll still be meeting the same 15 of us in the next 20 years, you know.
but you would also think that somebody who played this character that so many people look up to, and with, you know, this hero, this even though they knew that my character was fallible, they really hoped to think that I am Ivanova. So for me to come out and write this book and say, wow, I'm really more than fallible, and have people not turn against me, actually have them say, wow, we still love you, and we're going to help you with, you know, the next phase of your life. And that's what they've been doing. I mean, people have been donating to the C3 Foundation to make this documentary. And these are people who don't even have the impetus for it. You know, it's not like I'm helping them directly, but they know what I'm doing with other people. So every phase you do in your career, it seems like they support you. And I would like to give them the same amount of support that they've given me. So I'm trying my best to help people now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just a brilliant place to end. And as one of your fans, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. It's been such a delight reading your book. Now, I've heartily recommended it to people. I've never read a star autobiography quite like it before. There are good bits in the book as well. I just want to reassure people.
It's not all a downer.
She comes across as a very happy person.
No, there's some really fun bits, sweetie.
what's coming up next? When do we get to look forward to seeing you on our small screens again? Or our big screens, for that matter.
I did a couple of low-budget films before I left the States. One called Watercolor Postcards, which I think is going to festivals right now. The Wrong Woman I did with the lovely Danica. Oh, God, I'm forgetting her last name right now. She's the maths expert from Wonder Years. Danica.
Oh, Keller?
Keller.
Yes.
Yes, Danica Keller. Lovely, lovely woman. She. I did a film with her before I left L.A. But most importantly right now, I'm concentrating on Babylon Confidential, which is the book I wrote. They're doing a little push now for the audiobook and for the actual version that's out now. And of course, my documentary, which is One Little Pill. So you can find me on Facebook under One Little Pill, or The Sinclair Method, or Babylon Confidential, or Claudia Christian's fan page. You can also go to the c3foundation.org. To learn more about what I'm doing right now, and that's really what I'm focused on. So that's the next phase of my life. I don't know what's coming up after that.
Well, we wish you well with it, and again, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.